Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. Coming up this morning, rural working hubs in Castlecomer, County Kilkenny, cutting carbon emissions from our diet, making a home for the Atlantic salmon on the Liffey, and it is time to vote for your favourite Irish saint. 51551 for texts and countrywide at rte.ie. But we begin this morning on a Donegal farm. Back in 2017, the government set up a publicly funded programme to help save the bird species, the curlew, from what at that time was seen as their imminent extinction, with just 150 breeding pairs left. Well, the programme is now in its final year. Things don't look that good, but there are pockets of hope where the bird is faring well. And one of these pockets is on a farm in Inishowen. Hannah Quinn Mulligan reports.
This is the sound of a curlew guarding one of its fluffy, fragile chicks. Endangered with just 100 breeding pairs left in Ireland, the pair here on the Inishowen Peninsula in Donegal lost all of their chicks to a fox attack last year. But this summer, thanks to a new 2 kilometre fence surrounding 50 acres of farmland, they have successfully hatched and raised 3 chicks. I'm in Donegal to meet the farmer and the team behind the success story.
Hi Martin, how are you?
Hello Hannah, how are you doing? Welcome to Donegal. Rini Donegal. Paddy Connor's the farmer. Stephen's the nest protection officer.
And what's your role?
And I was the curlew advisory officer. We're in the Inishowen Peninsula, which is the most northerly peninsula in Ireland.
And there's been good news for the curlew, which is why we're here. So what is the good news for the curlew? Because it's a red species, endangered bird.
Yeah, the curlew basically, Hannah, in the 80s there was between 3,000 and 5,000 pairs in Ireland. And now there's only about 100 pairs left, which is, it's crazy, like it's somewhat over 96%, I think, drop. They could actually go extinct. And I think it's really important that we save the last few birds we have.
So yeah. How did that success come about? Stephen, you were involved in that.
Yeah, well, obviously the fence helped massively, because that period between the eggs hatching and the birds getting to about 5 weeks is a sort of a critical time, we think, you know, yeah. That the birds are up on their feet from more or less the day they hatch, and they can move about, and there's always something there. It could be an avian predator or a fox or something, every eye's on them. They just don't have a chance from the minute.
But you know. Were you watching them? Were you minding them as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, I mind them. I'd be here in the morning and night, and Pat here always, he's on the ground all the time, so he knows where they are probably more than I do. He's on the phone to me probably more times than my wife is during that time of the year, telling me where they are and what they're doing. And so I always know from Pat or Martin would be here previously, so I always know what's going on and where they are. But then you'd be out all night and as much as you can watching them, yeah.
And Pat, you're the farmer here. This is
right,
your land.
That's my land, yeah.
So what does the curlew mean to you?
The curlew's come in here for a long time. There used to be maybe 7 or 8 pair here way back maybe 40 years ago. Now there's just the 1 pair.
And we've talked a lot about this fence, but I haven't seen it yet. So you're going to walk us up the road now and we're going to meet the man who helped put it in. Is that right?
Aye, he's up the road there, aye.
The rain's getting heavier, so I suppose we better make a move.
Don't get rain here. Never stop for me.
Is it nice to hear them? Because it must be a sound from your childhood too.
You hear them calling you in the morning. 6:30 in the morning they'll be calling you. Well, that's nice to hear them calling in the morning.
It's part of the landscape, you know. It's really traditional sound. People working turf years ago would tell you that they were familiar with the call of the curlew, you know.
I always remember it last year when we were here, when the chicks were gone, when we lost the chicks last year.
Yeah.
And it was not noisy, but you could hear the birds every day, and they were flying, and then when the chicks were gone, the birds left, and it was almost eerily silent. It was disappointing, but the silence made it even more, you know, because they just left and it was quiet and that was it.
This is the man who built the fence. Stephen, how are you?
How are you?
It's nice to meet you.
Hannah.
How long is it, this fence?
It's about 1,900 metres there in total, nearly 2 kilometres, yeah.
So not only is it, it's what, about 2 metres high?
Yeah, it's just shy of 2 metres.
And 1,900 miles. Electrified?
Yeah.
It's very sheep-proof as well,
and
it goes under the ground.
Yeah, it's buried in the ground as well to stop anything digging.
Badgers or foxes digging or anything. That is quite intense. I'll bring in the other Stephen here, because was there a moment that you were saying earlier where a fox did get through?
About 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was coming down from this hill up here, and I use a thermal imaging device to check, you know, that obviously chews up the heat, and it was a bit of a panic. Eventually we found out where he was coming from. It was actually a drain under the road, which I don't even think Pat knew it was here, and the boys got it sealed up and closed very quickly, so that solved the problem. But it was a bit of a panic at the time. The chicks were on the ground at that time as well, so the fence, and then people like Martin and Pat. I'd be here at night time, and people who I don't even know stop in cars at 12 o'clock at night. Are the birds here? How's the chicks getting on? You know, so everybody's involved, and it's nice. And it's nice now to tell them when they do pull in again, well, the chicks fledged and they flew, and the fence helped, and yeah.
Was that the difference between kind of success and failure?
It was a big, big help, because before the fence was up, when you were leaving here, your heart was in your mouth. You know, you're afraid someone's going to happen.
That's true.
But when the fence was there, you felt you could go home and feel secure.
Pat, I'm interested in your perspective as the farmer, because there's an awful lot of sheep here. They're your sheep,
they're my sheep.
So how many sheep would you have here?
Oh, about 150.
Across how much land? How many acres do we have?
Probably maybe 70 down there, and about 20 hectares maybe.
And the fence seems to, like we were mentioning, it's nearly 2 kilometres long. So how many acres does it cover?
Probably about 50 acres, yeah.
How did the sheep find it?
Well, I took the sheep off for a couple of months there. So there's plenty of grass, then they went back again.
They aren't able to escape as well, are they?
No, they can't get out, no.
that has to be a plus. Yeah. If there were other farmers, because I imagine, Martin and Stephen, you'd like to see something like this fence rolled out into other areas because it was so successful. Would you tell other farmers that this fence doesn't impact their land? Or?
Yeah, definitely, you have a good fence.
Is it worth it, though, in terms of the time that you have to take the sheep off and then able to put them back in? Is it worth all that?
Oh, that's surely, yeah. See, the fence will be a good saviour. I would say the birds will get away now. They've got away the year, so I think it'll be looking good for next year again, hopefully.
How many birds would you like to see next year?
Hopefully next year we'd have an extra couple of birds next year. And you come back next year.
If you make that happen, I'll be here. How about that?
Good stuff.
Amazing stuff there from Pat, Martin and Stephen. Hannah Quinn Mulligan talking to them there in Donegal, and best of luck to them. Now, there was a discussion last week about a tweet sent by the Environmental Protection Agency, which recommended that in order to cut our greenhouse gas emissions, we could slowly reduce our red meat intake. The EPA then decided to delete the tweet. In a statement to us, the EPA told us that to reduce this complex debate to a single tweet would diminish the seriousness of the discussion that we need to have. Well, Chagas has been looking at this question of emissions from food as part of an All-Ireland research project on what the Irish public is currently eating compared to what is recommended for both personal and planetary health. And it shows that a reduction in meat intake and an increase in vegetables would significantly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And one of the researchers from Chagas, Dr. Sinead McCarthy, joins me now. Good morning, Sinead. Thanks a million for coming in. You have a PhD in public health nutrition, and for 10 years you managed many of the national food consumption surveys in Trinity, and for Chagas you're involved in this research. Before we start, just for the sake of full transparency, who funded this research?
Thanks for having me in, Ella, and delighted to come in this morning and discuss this very important topic with you. This research has been funded by the Department of Agriculture through what's known as their firm funding food research instrument. All of the research that I'll discuss with you today is undertaken in collaboration with other universities such as Queen's, UCD and UCC.
Any industry funding?
There is no industry funding whatsoever.
So just thinking about it, in the past, dietary guidelines, as I remember them anyway, were all about nutrition and health. And the basic message was always eat more fruit and vegetables. But now we obviously need to think about the sort of a parallel thing, which is our greenhouse gas emissions from the food that we eat. That is the core of what your research looked at. What is a sustainable diet, both for our health and for planetary health?
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose the food pyramid was launched just over 30 years ago. And what's in that then is pretty much the same, only for a few small changes now, and still very much applies in terms of health. And the food pyramid is designed such that if we eat the balance as described in the pyramid, we will get a healthy diet that gives us all our nutrients that we require. So what we decided to look at then was, if we follow these healthy dietary guidelines that are outlined in the food pyramid, is that also more sustainable? Or do we need to put a different layer, if you like, onto the pyramid to bring in that sustainability piece when it comes to sustainable diets?
And when you say sustainable, what you're meaning is the greenhouse gas emissions from the foods that are recommended.
Exactly, yeah. And that's only one metric involved in looking at sustainable diets as well. There's water use and many other measures. But for this particular study, we just looked at the greenhouse gas emissions.
And what did you find?
So what we found was, If you think of the pyramid as being a very stable structure with a wide base on it, we have the fruit and veg at the bottom, and you should be eating most of your food from the bottom of the pyramid. The recommendation is at least 5 and has increased to 7 recently. At the moment, we're eating about 2, 2.5. So you can imagine that very narrow base, it's left that pyramid unstable. As we move up the pyramid, we're fairly okay when it comes to the whole grains and the cereal shelf. We're fairly good when it comes to the dairy shelf as well. We're eating there or thereabouts within what's recommended. When we come up to the meat and protein shelf, we're just slightly outside by about a portion a day of what we should be eating. And then fats and oils, not too bad. But when we get up to the very top of the shelf, we're eating 600 grams a day from the top of the shelf. Nearly 3 times more of what we're eating from fruit and veg. So you can see it's top heavy and weak at the bottom. So it's as if
so
it's
we're
going
not
to
listening
topple.
To the recommendations.
It's as if it's going to topple. Yeah. So what we looked at then was if we increase the fruit and veg, decrease the meat slightly and halve our intake of the discretionary foods as they're known from the top of the pyramid, what would the carbon consequences be, if you like? And we could reduce, we could take about 1.6 kilos of carbon out of our diets or out of what we're consuming if we were to reduce our intake by that amount.
I read a presentation of yours and it listed the carbon emission factors for different foods. So that's the amount of CO2 equivalent per kilogram. Carrots were 0.5, potatoes were 1.5, cheese was 9.2 and red meat was 32.4.
But we don't eat individual foods. And that's one of the really important points to make. You don't go home, have dinner and just have a plate of meat or just have a plate of carrots. We have a combination of foods on that plate. And that's the piece that's important. And that's why we need to eat a combination of foods to get the balance right. So you need your protein from your meat. You need all of the inherent healthy elements that we get from fruit and veg. So the phytochemicals that give fruit and veg their colour is what makes them healthy. They're very high in vitamins, they're also low in calories, so they help fill us up.
And I can hear the vegetarians and vegans out there saying, no, I can get my protein other ways, so we'll just make sure that they're accounted for. But
yes,
with regard to the takeaway,
just on the protein piece, though, you need to eat 4 times the amount of a plant protein to get the same amount. So you'd need to eat about 400 grams of chickpeas to get the same amount of protein as what you'll get in 100 grams of red meat.
Overall, do we need to cut red meat in order to reduce our carbon emissions?
Only slightly. We need to get the shelf back into balance. We need to eat the appropriate amounts for what we need for our requirements. So we need to reduce the protein shelf by about, if we reduce it by about one portion, that'll give us a saving of approximately 1.5 kilos of carbon per day.
That's one portion per day you're talking about.
That's one portion per day. If we have our sweets, chocolates, treats, alcohol especially, and this part of the food pyramid we don't hear discussed very much in this sustainability debate, but we're eating far in excess of our requirements. There actually isn't a requirement for the treats. So if we have that, which is still above what's recommended, we can have a saving of about 1 kilo a day of carbon. And just to put, I think it's really important in this whole sustainability debate that we absolutely have to consume food. We can't do without it. And not go back to hard times 3 years ago of COVID, but when we were isolated and locked down, food became the primary objective in our lives. Getting to the shops, getting our foods were really important. We didn't need to drive beyond 2 kilometres. We didn't need to take flights. So we have to eat. So the carbon cost of our diet is a given. We have to do that.
But is it the case that if you want, and if you've got a balanced diet, but if you want to address this question of reducing your greenhouse gas emissions, that the quickest and easiest way to do that is to cut red meat?
No, it's to have reduce red meat and have the discretionary foods as well.
The Irish food pyramid, as you said, is 30 years old and it looks just at this question of public health. Is it time that we looked at it again? I mean, 30 years is a long time ago. But and also integrate what you're talking about, which is these other ways of looking at it, which is about the carbon emissions.
Yeah, and that is happening as well. And I think the important aspect is to not over-focus on one shelf, and it's about getting the balance from all of the shelves. Revision, so that from a nutritional perspective, it's still fit for purpose. And as beings, we have haven't changed that much in the last 30 years, that our requirements have changed. But we do very much need to change our behaviour and align what we're consuming with the recommendations. In terms of sustainability, a lot of work is going on in that space. There was a report launched earlier this year by the Climate and Health Alliance, and the recommendations that they're making for a more climate friendly and sustainable diet is not very different from what the current food pyramid is showing. I think what could be helpful for consumers in terms of having choice for everybody out there for whatever type of diet you'd like to choose is that if on each shelf there was an indication of which foods are higher and which foods are lower in terms of their carbon footprint, and do that for every one of the shelves, because all of the foods we have ultimately have a carbon cost, whether it's low or high.
Do you think there is trust in the food pyramid? Because from what you said earlier, people aren't following it for a reason.
I don't think it's a lack of trust. I think it's that huge area of consumer behaviour, which would be an entirely different radio interview, Ella. We get stuck in habits, and changing our habits can be very difficult. We eat for taste. We're primarily driven by taste rather than health. And the food pyramid is probably promoted more so on a basis of health. So perhaps that taste piece, helping people in their daily lives to incorporate it into their lives, bringing your apple in your handbag or school bag as the snack rather than maybe some salty, high fat crisps or something like that.
And you mentioned in it this idea of a realistic and culturally appropriate solutions for a sustainable diet. So you're not just looking at the facts and the figures. Talk to me a bit about that. What do you mean by culturally appropriate?
So culturally appropriate is one that fits in with the culture of a population or where you're living. So it's about making recommendations for foods that are available to you, foods that you know how to use, foods that you know how to cook with. So say, for example, for some people might not know what to do with lentils. So making a recommendation for a sustainable diet that's just based on lentils wouldn't be culturally appropriate for some populations. Similarly, in the Eat Lancet report that kind of launched a lot of these discussions, they recommended replacing potatoes with rice. Now, while rice consumption has gone up in Ireland, we have a love for our potato. And that's our cultural piece, if you like. It's also grown domestically. It's not flown 4,000 miles for us to consume it.
And on the question of food miles, we've a tweet in here, a text rather, saying, why aren't we talking about food miles and flying vegetables such as avocados halfway around the world as part of this conversation? Surely less food miles is just as important as reducing meat intake.
If food miles is so, as I was saying earlier, the carbon emissions is only one element of a sustainable diet. We can bring in water use, we can bring in food miles, and transportation. It doesn't make sense that you can get something from thousands of miles away and consume it here. One of the big recommendations in terms of sustainable diets is eating locally produced foods and seasonal foods, and that's a good place to start
if you can find them.
If you can find
them. In case of vegetables, it's actually quite hard in Ireland.
Yeah.
Another text. Ask, please, can you ask Sinead about infant feeding? In terms of infants drinking full fat milk from age one, is it healthier, more sustainable option than them drinking follow on formula, which has a huge carbon burden in its processing and is unnecessary as per HSE and WHO? Is that correct?
I'm not familiar with the current guidelines for infant feeding. It's about 14 years since I've had to worry about infant feeding.
So you didn't look at the emissions associated
with
formula?
No, it was just adult food consumption for 18 to 16.
So for people going out this morning on their shop or going into a restaurant and having takeaway food or whatever, what's the take-home message for them? If they're interested in this one question, which is, how do I pull back? How do I reduce a bit my greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, if you want to combine both healthy eating and greenhouse gas emissions, what I would recommend is look at your plate. And if you imagine half of your plate should be fruit and vegetables, a quarter of your plate should be your protein, and then the other quarter of your plate should be carbohydrate. If you're thinking of in terms of if that protein is meat, approximately the palm of your hand is what a portion size is. So when you're eating your two portions of protein a day, think of two hands. That's the amount of protein that you actually want to consume.
So we're back to what was meat and two veg, but now is, if people are vegetarian, whatever they want, or vegan, the protein and two veg. As being the essence. Sinead McCarthy, thank you very much for joining us. We're
thank
on 51551. We're back after this.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, and thank you to Sinead McCarthy for coming in. She's on her way now to the Glen Emmets in Tully Allen, the under 15 girls, to see her daughter play. Best of luck to them this morning. Angling tourism is an important source of income for many rural areas, and this includes people who travel here to fish Atlantic salmon. An important home for salmon is the River Liffey, which begins life in the Wicklow Mountains and then flows through Kildare and Dublin before entering the Irish Sea out through the capital into Dublin Bay. But along the Liffey, there are barriers, and these are stopping the salmon from being able to breed. Angler Mark McAndrews has set up a non-profit called the Liffey Salmon Project, and they've secured public funding from the Electricity Supply Board and Inland Fisheries Ireland, along with private funding from Intel, to try and help the salmon on the Liffey. The work is being done by Alan Sullivan from Rivas Ecological Engineering. Well, I went down during the week to meet Mark in West Dublin, and I began by asking him how salmon numbers are doing in Irish rivers this year.
Definitely this year, by all accounts nationwide, everyone is panicking. Like rivers that should have fish, people aren't even seeing fish anymore. So I think this is the first. We've been told for years that this is going to happen, and it's the first big red flag. Okay, so at the moment we're below the wren's nest weir. We're right in the middle of the strawberry beds here. We're surrounded by city, but there's a few fields either side of us where it's all completely natural. You have a valley. There's a lot of wildlife here. You see buzzards and sparrowhawks and peregrines go. It's like going back in time.
It's so weird to think that we are... I mean, if we kayaked down the Liffey here, within a few minutes we'd be under the Halfpenny Bridge.
Yes, exactly. And this starts right up at Chapel Izzard, which is virtually right in the city centre. And then if you go either side of this, you're in Clondalkin, you're in Liffey Valley. It's all very built up all the way over there. And to go over this side, you're Castleknock, Blanchardstown. But there's sort of a green strip, a green belt all the way down the Liffey that has been preserved from development. There'll be salmon in that pool right now, probably small enough in number because of the decline, but there will be salmon in this stretch right now. Most of the salmon will have come in already.
And what are you trying to do here? What's your project?
Our project is to reinstate the spawning gravels that aren't making it down the river. So in a river where that's free-flowing, you would have gravels coming from the Liffey, from the Dublin Mountains, and it would end up in places like this for the salmon to spawn. They build their nest in the gravel, so they dig a nest, and the gravel allows oxygen to get at the eggs. And it has to be done in a certain type of habitat, so it needs to be sort of fast-flowing, low-water, glidy habitat like this, which is very rare on the Liffey. What we found when we looked at this side in particular is that there was an absence of spawning gravel altogether. So what we're doing is we're artificially putting in gravel that would normally flow down a river so that isn't full of barriers.
And why is the gravel not coming down?
So it's been caught behind the weirs, and there's three dams on the Liffey system, and then you've got seven barriers here, and there's a couple above the dam and leaks it. So at the moment, the lower Liffey, which is holding most of the Liffey salmon, 70% of it is impounded by weirs. So 100% of that should be free-flowing, but 70% is dead and lifeless. That's having a major effect. So if we got a couple of barriers out, that would double or triple their spawning sites. Climate change, the water temperatures are heating. The area above the weirs, the water is cooking up there now. So if we're going to keep salmon and trout in our rivers and fight climate change, I think barriers need to be something that has to go.
Why were the weirs put in the first place?
So the weirs were for industrial mills. So this would have been, there would have been a mill here that would have served an industrial function in the Victorian ages. And then when the mill packed up or didn't serve a function, they left the weir behind. It would have had a mill race down the side and would have created hydropower. They were harnessing that power of the river. They didn't understand the effect it was having on the river. So eventually it created a barrier for the fish. If you look at the area below the weir, so that's flowing more naturally because it's not backed up. When you look at above the weir, this one does nearly a mile. In that dead sort of water, you don't have trout and salmon spawning. You don't have juvenile trout and salmon. But it's completely unnatural for the Liffey to be like this. The Liffey should be free-flowing.
And the weir itself, can the salmon get up that?
Salmon can get up this with a lot of difficulty. The science actually stresses them out when they're caught below a barrier for a long period of time. But also the main thing is the smolts coming down. They get very nervous at these barriers and they stay here for an artificially long time.
The smolts are young salmon.
Yeah, the smolts are the young salmon. So they get predated upon and they also get stressed. So the smolts in rivers where there's no barriers get out in a couple of days. On the river like the Liffey, where there's a lot of barriers, it could be weeks, and we have dams to contend with. So we're losing smolts all the way down.
Just how precarious is the Atlantic salmon now and the population? I mean, what's your prediction if things don't get better?
No, it's been terrible across the board in say most rivers in Ireland. So the Moy really struggled, the Blackwater. These are rivers that get thousands of salmon. So I think the big hit will be angling tourism in the next few years. We're going to lose millions from visiting anglers coming to fish here. So it's a big loss to the economy if we lose salmon.
We're coming into the start of the flooding season when people understandably get very concerned
about their houses flooding, their land flooding. Is there evidence to show the dredging works?
No, I don't think so. There's an experiment done in the Stonyford River where they found that they didn't drain it, and they found that the flooding was similar from when they did dredge it. The risk when we dredge it is effectively you're killing all the life in the river. You're taking the riffle pool glide, you're taking the bends out of the river, you're turning the river, a bit like what the barriers are doing, you're turning the river into a canal. So there's actually a lot of in-stream work now being done by using the same fund we use to try and put features back into rivers to create riffle pool glide.
So if there's no evidence that dredging works, for people who are concerned, what should they be arguing for? What's the best way to mitigate flood risk?
The best way, so there's a project being done on the Dodder at the moment where they're rewilding the upper stretch of Dodder, they're putting in trees and stuff and they're re-wetting the bog. What will happen then is when it rains, the bog and the trees will hold the water back and release it at a much slower flow. Having riparian zones, so a lot of rivers have lost their riparian zones, all that has an effect on the water. And having little buffer zones between the river and any development or any agriculture, let it be natural, and then we'll have less flooding.
So we've come off the road into a field. This is actually adjoined by the Liffey, and this is where the works are happening. And come down the bank here.
So this is the first site we've put the spawning gravel. So if you see the difference in the colour, that's all fresh gravel that was put in.
Ah, there.
Yes.
Okay.
You see it.
So underneath the water, you can just see like what looks like a kind of cloud of gravel.
Yes, that's exactly it. So that's all the new stuff being put in. So there was an absence of that in this stretch. So we should see now in December or January, is salmon starting to use that.
I'm sure there is a lot more to it than what I'm about to say, but essentially the diggers come and they pour the gravel all the way along.
Yeah, so it only goes into specific areas. So it's going in the tail of the pool. This is where a pool is ending, and then you have the riffle below, which is the next pool. Alan here, who does it, is very experienced, the Rebus Limited, but they put it in and then he has it in a certain shape so that it's tailing out. So the dumper puts it in and then the track machine will come in and disperse it afterwards in a specific way.
Hi, Alan Sullivan at Rebus Limited.
You were in charge of the works here, putting the gravel in. Presumably on your wish list would be remove the weirs.
Absolutely. The 1958 Fisheries Act states very clearly that if a weir is not being used for the purpose for which it was built, either in the milling of grain or producing power, then it should be removed.
And for people who understandably look at the weir in, you know, in their local river and feel horrified about the idea that it would be removed, what do you say to them?
I'm being very straight. It isn't about them. You know, this is an emergency. I mean, our biodiversity is diminishing. It's existential. I have never seen a human action designed to make a river better actually work. Never. Not once in my life. In the past, to fix this bank here, people would have dumped a load of rock armour. Rock armour does not absorb energy, but leaves, branches, slow water down. They're like little lightning conductors. The rocks actually create a ball of energy, and the next thing is that the bank starts disappearing below it. I mean, I've seen so many times where a farmer is on a corner of a river, has put in rock armour, and the next corner down on his neighbour's gets obliterated. Then he has to put rock armour in.
The water quality at the Liffey, and particularly in this section, is probably better than it's ever been. So I have video here in the summer where you can't see your hand in front of your face with mayfly and other insects, really. So the criticism of the Liffey back in the 90s was there was a lot of sludge and stuff coming out of the wastewater treatment plants. That's not happening anymore. So it is much cleaner than it has been. And we feel that if we get the substrate in here, you know, the numbers will rebound.
Mark McAndrews from the Liffey Salmon Project with Alan Sullivan there. And coincidentally, today apparently is International Women's Fly Fishing Day. It's a worldwide initiative to encourage more women to take up fly fishing. And it's the brainchild, actually, of an Irish woman called Maddie Kelly. She's an international angler. And she's done a really interesting long interview on the latest Ireland on the Fly podcast. And if you're interested in angling and fishing and all things rivers, that podcast is worth a listen. 51551 on our texts. We're going now to jobs. And demand for rural hubs has increased over the last year as a growing number of people are working remotely 2 to 3 days a week. Well, in Kilkenny, half of the homes sold in the last few months were bought by people with addresses outside of the county who are moving there for a better work-life balance. This week, Della Kilroy visited a former school in Castle Comer, which has been repurposed into a remote working hub.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Gerard Ryan. I'm standing here in my co-working space with my partner Dominica. We moved here just a month ago. It's a former classroom in the Enterprise Centre in Castlecomer, which was formerly a school. It's bright and airy. It's got four large windows. I'm looking out and all I can see is trees, which is really nice, fitting with the rural area, I suppose.
I'm in North Kilkenny with plumber Gerard and his artist wife Dominica. Last year, the couple moved with their three children to farmland close by and started working in their local business centre.
This is a printmaking press for linocut printing. So it's nice to have a space that could facilitate all the elements of work. Up until now, I had my computer at home, which wasn't a healthy habit. I used to just sit down and work up until late evening when kids were asleep, and it just really affects the balance and the mental health, I suppose. There's no time off when you're working for yourself. You're always trying to do as much, especially when you have small kids. So it's nice to have a bit of balance now.
So we were formerly living in Athy, in the town, like commuter towns. It was house to house. And I suppose when we seen the house in Ballinakil, the rural setting, the fields, the air, I was sold on the idea, really. We're there now. We're happy out. Haven't looked back.
What is daily life like now, living in a more rural setting?
Like every family, I suppose, it's the chase to the deadline for school, first of all. But it's no traffic and you do get a lot of benefit out of the rural vibe and kind of being closer to nature and the quality of air, I think, as well. I think people underestimate that.
It just feels much less stressful, both of us being self-employed. I suppose it's really nice to have a space now to work when Gerard can come as well and do his office admin tasks, because it's so hectic at home. You know, the kids are 1, 8 and 9, 8 and 9 or 7 and 8. But it's really loud, and it's really happy loud, but it's very hectic and there's no chance of getting any work done, so.
That'd be a big one. And then to answer your question about me, I suppose I have been given a little corner here. If anyone on the radio can see it, I've been shoved in the corner here. That's a joke. But no, it's a lovely space. And, you know, if I have an hour in the evening, it's not going home to do it. It's popping in here for an hour before I go home, and then I'm going home with a clear head and I can just focus on home life.
Gerard and Dominica aren't the only ones making the move to Kilkenny. Across the county, remote working hubs are dealing with increased demand. Aileen McGrath works in Kilkenny's local enterprise office.
Okay, so we're currently in Castlecomer, which is a lovely town in the north of Kilkenny. We're walking now through the Castlecomer Enterprise Centre. And when the school closed, there was an opportunity arose for the community to take on this unit, and they've developed it into various enterprise units and remote working desks. So there's lots of different businesses located in units across the campus.
What is demand like for this kind of remote working space at the moment?
Yes, we're finding across the whole of County Kilkenny that enterprise spaces like these are in high demand. We've seen a little bit of data to show that a good number of the houses recently purchased in Kilkenny were purchased from registered owners outside of Kilkenny. So that shows that people are moving back to Kilkenny and that there is a demand for housing. COVID really put an emphasis on it. And for employees, it's part of the job spec. A lot of people inquire, is it something that's possible when they're applying for a job? So we're seeing the demand from both the employee and the interest from both employers and employees.
What then are the national trends you're seeing with these kind of hubs?
Different counties and different areas nationally are at different points of their journey in relation to it. So here in Kilkenny, we have a number of established units, and then we have a new centre coming on stream in Urlingford, Exit 4, in an old bank. And that feeds into communities then and keeps communities alive and people living here, going to sports, going to different clubs and amenities. So it's really important to facilitate in any way that we can people living and working in rural towns such as this in Castlecomer, but in the whole of County Kilkenny. It's really lovely to have facilities like this so people can come and live and work here.
We're currently standing in the middle of one end of my small little shop, which is beside the deli. Small 600 square foot footfall area here, deals with a lot of people who are quite busy, as Comer is a quite busy town.
Just down the road from the centre, David O'Rourke runs O'Rourke's Quick Pick. It's a family-run newsagent, with David's dad opening the shop over 50 years ago.
business is changing rapidly, and even since COVID more rapidly. It's busier, it's shorter term busy, it's the big shop doesn't go on as much anymore, of course. It's just people are moving earlier. Yeah, the Enterprise Centre, apart from the shop, it has made a tremendous difference to the town, because it has given people a chance and a foot up to get going. Now, as regards myself and the town and business, it's holding people in the town, which is the mainstay.
This town historically has been rocked by...
Oh, historically we've been rocked time and time again. Go back to the mines back in the late 60s when that closed. It was a tremendous source of employment. I mean, the whole Comer area, there was a lack of immigration out of Comer down through the years and the whole area due to the fact that there was employment here, be it tough and be it not that great paid, but it held people through the years when people had to emigrate elsewhere out of the country. Then we had the closure of the mines, and factories did replace it to some degree and created employment, but we've since lost those. But Comer keeps fighting, because Comer is very much community-based and very much back up to each other. Comer just keeps supporting itself, and we fight above our weight.
So you'll keep fighting?
We'll keep fighting. We'll always keep fighting. That spirit is here. And we gang together, and yeah.
Well, the lunch crowd are coming in, so I'll let you get back to work.
All right. Thanks very much.
Great stuff there from David O'Rourke talking to Della Kilroy in Kilkenny. Well, if you're in Galway tomorrow morning, you could consider heading down to the docks, because you'll be able to visit a French registered sailing vessel called Tara, which is here with a crew of scientists. They're surveying the coast of Ireland as part of their European work. They're taking a snapshot of the health of our waters. Lorna Siggins stepped aboard and she met Emmanuel Boss, the chief scientist.
This is a very different mission in the sense that previous ones we would go for a month at a time. This is the captain, Martin.
Oh, hello.
We met the big star of the boat.
He said you're the big star. Yeah,
he's the real star, so it's good. I mean, I don't want to interrupt. It's the first time that we have a land team connected to a boat on a wide scale such as Europe.
For the next few days, you're going out to sea again?
Sure, for 3 days in a row. Sampling around the bay. We have two stations connected with a land team, and then we keep going south, because the aim is to do the same protocol in the 22 countries of Europe with a maritime border. So then France, again, Spain, Portugal. Then we stop for the winter, and then we start again in March, end of February 2024, from Gibraltar to Greece.
As most of the 14 crew and scientists on board Tara visited Galway before returning to sea, the chief scientist, Emmanuel Boss, explained just why this research expedition is so different.
You do have people studying Lang Ocean in, let's say, San Francisco Bay in California, but they do it differently than somebody would do it in Kiel, Germany, and those are not therefore necessarily comparable. Here, because we do everything the same way, and protocols have been agreed upon with the MBL, with Tara scientists, with everybody, it makes for a data set that's absolutely unique. Tara is a unique platform, again, because of that systematic measurement done everywhere, meaning it's comparable between west coast and east coast of continents. It goes to places that very few boats go to.
Going down below?
Yeah, so this is where the captain and the rest of the crew, the watches, the engines are here, but also we have a shop. If we need to repair things, we can repair them. And we have an amazing coop on board, so we eat really well. This was designed for Arctic work, I mean high latitude work, Arctic and Antarctic
work. So it's ice strengthened, is
since
it?
It's, if ice close on it, you bring in the centerboard, it's actually sideboards here.
Yeah.
You bring them in and the ice can close and Tara would float on top of it. It has done a Nansen-like drift.
Has it?
Yes.
So it drifted until
it got out of
the
ice. Yes. Yeah, they did it in 2006 to 2008. There's a lab here, another lab. We have an automated microscope called a flow cam here. We have several other ones. So we take images of zooplankton and phytoplankton and a variety.
So what's it like working in there when it's rolling around?
Depends on how you deal with it.
How you feel, what you had at breakfast.
Some people, exactly. Another thing that's very unique on Tara that doesn't happen on any other research vessel, everybody cleans the toilet. Doesn't matter if you're chief scientist, if you're captain of the boat, that we have a chore wheel, all the chores based on the day of the week. The relationship here between crew and scientist is tighter than any other boat I've ever been on.
Right.
Salut, salut, salut! When you come into it, it's a commitment. It's a commitment to interact with the public that's going to come on board during the weekend, and we'll be here too. And this is only, Tara is the only vessel I know who does it. Typical boats in the academic fleet, the moment they get to port, they put fences, don't come in. So it's a very different rapport with the public. And I like it. I mean, my son would say I drank the Kool-Aid.
And we are in the middle of a marine heat wave now.
We're in a lot of marine changes. Not necessarily all for bad, as far as we can tell, but the ocean is getting more acidic. It's getting warmer. So the ocean is changing. And it's changing to a large degree because of human behavior, what we do in order to have the lifestyle we like having. It's a good time to both get baselines, because in many places we have no data. So we'll have something to compare to, and in other places where we have data to continue these time series so we can actually tell about the changes that are happening and tie them to processes that are happening on the globe or locally. For example, it's likely we'll see organisms that used to be further south from us migrate further north, and we've seen that. In the Gulf of Maine, we used to have a shrimp. I love to eat, and the fisheries has closed for almost 15 years, and last time I ate it was in Greenland, where they fish the same shrimp very nicely and happily. One of the best ways to fight it is marine protected area. Some zones where there's no take whatsoever, so fish can grow in there. And I'm actually quite happy as we sailed here to see all the windmills, because in between them, trawlers cannot trawl. And so they would serve as green energy, but also as places where marine life could thrive. So that's wonderful.
Lorna Siggins there on board the French vessel Tara. It's open to the public tomorrow morning, starting from 10 o'clock. The forecast is great, so if you're over in Galway, it's definitely worth dropping in. Thank you all for your texts. That's about it from us this morning. Thank you to Damien Chanel on sound, Brian Moss, our broadcast coordinator, and Brian Lally, our producer. I'm going to leave you with Bishop Dennis Nulty of Kildare and Loughlin, because the Ploughing Championships start in 2 weeks, and he will be there, and he'll be there for one reason only, and that is he wants to find out Ireland's favourite saint. We'll talk to you next week.
I decided on saints because for the last number of years, our diocese presence at the Ploughing, we've been looking at Ireland's favourite poem, Ireland's favourite prayer, Ireland's favourite hymn was last year. There'll be 100,000 probably there every day. And we hope that some of them will call into the Kildare and Loughlin stand and be with us for the journey of the Ploughing and be part of our conversation. Saint Bridget is very much high in the esteem, having got a special bank holiday assigned to her announced last year. We have great devotion to Bridget. But this is about what saint most appeals to you. I'm interested to find out and see where exactly devotion to saints are. I know people for whom church may not be as strong, but they still have a very strong devotion to a particular saint. And when there's a Christ in the family, they turn to that saint. Anthony helps you finding things. Jude will help you when you're feeling hopeless about things. And maybe Joseph of Cupertino we turn to at times of exams. The same way as the great devotion people have to Padre Pio at the time of sickness and illness. Huge devotion to people like Blessed Carlo Acutis, who was a coder, computer programmer. And he died only in 2006 and beatified in 2020. People are interacting very well already by sending emails or contacting me or letting me know who their favourite is. We're taking note of every nomination that comes in. And that will continue. So people call into our stand 326. We'll take note of everyone that calls in and the saint. And there'll be a quiet poll done. And day three of the Ploughing, we will then have a vote during the people who call into the stand again and vote for their favourite saint out of those top three, whoever they may be. And everyone is most welcome to visit us on stand 326.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.